the state is fundamentally useless and inept and kind of knows it, and we just keep on piling regulation on law-abiding people.
How dare they? Mm. They basically go around saying adults don't like sweet things.
Awful. Absolutely. Chris Whitty's awful. This country is a waste of space. Where are we going to move?
It's not. Absolutely not. We've got to stay and fight the good fight.
Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Dr. Christopher Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
All right, Tom. Not too bad. Mustn't grumble.
Excellent. And we're delighted to be joined by our favourite returning guest, Claire Fox, many people will know from the House of Lords, as well as the director of the Academy of Ideas. How are you doing, Claire?
Very good to be with you.
So we've got a lot to talk about, and I thought we'd start off with, Claire, the tobacco and vapes bill, not least because it's been in the House of Lords last week. It's at second reading. You've had more of an opportunity to kind of pore over this piece of legislation, which, as people will remember, is fundamentally about ushering in the total prohibition of tobacco via this insane age escalator that we might get into. But there's also things within it about vapes and disposable vapes and flavours and so on. Do you want to tell us what you've been making of the bill now that you're looking at it in kind of line by line detail at the moment?
Yeah, so the second reading was a kind of general outline of what people would think about the bill. And I do think it is a lot worse than I imagined, if you can imagine that in your head, right? Because I recognised that this generational ban was happening. But first of all, the Labour government have just done a cut-and-paste version of what the Conservative government did, which means that the Tories are all over the place. I don't know whether they're for or against it. But what the Labour government has also done is it's introduced a whole range of effectively executive power grabs, which means that the Secretary of State in the future can introduce very many more regulatory examples of madness, right, as we go forward. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I genuinely think this. I don't think that some of the people who are most opposed to smoking understand the difference between tobacco and nicotine, if I can just say it. So it just all gets lumped in. So it's like, what are they trying to ban? What is it that they are most upset about? And that's where the attack on vaping comes in. As always, in the name of protecting the children, adult vaping is now going to be very curtailed. Because we all want to say things, I just want to do a couple of plugs. One is, I've got my badge on here, which is the Torch of Freedom, the Torch of Liberty, which is our smokers, the Lord's Smokers badge, so that you know. I want everybody to see it. And because there's a group of people who call the Terrace Club, where we're basically in a shed outside where we're allowed to smoke or vape. So we all go there, and there's kind of some resistance to the bill from those quarters. But I've just picked up, and it just sums up my feelings about this, the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, committee stage, the first amendments are in. They're in from Lord Bethel, who was a former Tory minister, but also the Tory front bench. And I can assure you that not an ounce of liberalism is involved in this. There is no sense of, in other words, the Tory front bench, I'm afraid, are pushing for stronger regulatory powers even than the bill has got. And so you can imagine that even though there will be some backbench opposition to this bill, I'm afraid that is going to be an uphill battle, but at least we can have the arguments out.
So Bethel, his amendment is to ban tobacco completely in 2040.
Outright, yeah. For all ages, yeah. At once.
That's,
okay.
That's just one of his amendments.
It's like but saying the quiet part out loud. Yeah. Just wait for this bit to go through before you start giving away what the real endgame is.
You know? I think that's the thing, Chris, is that I will be saying in committee stage, when we go through it line by line, I will be saying, why don't you just make it illegal? You know, this is a former... No, well, you might as well...
10 years ago, you could use that argument, but these days people just go, you're right, yeah, we should.
No, but prohibition is what we've got, but they won't admit it. They haven't got the courage to admit it. Mm-hmm. And what is really galling is when, therefore, you have people standing up saying, we aren't trying to ban adults from smoking. It's like, you are trying to introduce a situation in which nobody will be able to buy tobacco. But, of course, it is, by the way, contradictory. Mm-hmm. Because you can't buy it, but it's not illegal to smoke.
No.
Right? So all that will happen is for once I agree that this is a problem, there will be a black market. But you will get your mates to buy it. But can you imagine a situation in which you basically simply have to get somebody else to buy your fags for you? Right?
As an adult. Yeah.
As an adult. So it's pathetic. But then you say to your 36-year-old mate, as you're 35 and a half, can you go and get the fags, right? And then, but you can then go and smoke them on the street. So it makes no sense. The other thing that I was stressing in second reading was the disastrous impact this is going to have on corner shops, convenience stores. Mm. I've talked to a lot of the guys who run these shops in particular, and they are bemused, and so am I, that the Labour Party have patted themselves on the back for bringing in a really ridiculous and stupid law, which is to make it a special law that will make it illegal to assault retail workers, as though it isn't already illegal to assault retail workers. And this is because they say that retail workers in shops need to be protected. And then they're bringing in a bill which is going to guarantee that every retail worker in the country is going to be saying to people, are you 21 and a half versus your 21, or, you know, whatever it is. So, yeah, disastrous. My final despair is that the way that the tobacco companies are dealing with this is to call for raising the age of tobacco buying to 21. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, in a sort of talk about a defensive maneuver, kind of like a moment of despair where they say it's more practical to do it this way. And I will be opposing that as well. So,
absolutely. I mean, one thing that I noted from your speech in the House of Lords, Claire, was the fact that this really hasn't been implemented anywhere, certainly not successfully. I mean, you gestured to the fact that New Zealand were going to implement this plan and then realised it was just completely unworkable. And I suppose we should say, whilst Last Orders listeners will know this bill inside and out, the fundamental point of it is that the smoking age will rise by 1 year every year until it's basically illegal to smoke for everyone. But obviously you have this absurd situation. If you're on either side of the boundary, you're effectively telling people on a basis of a completely arbitrary date whether or not they have the right to buy cigarettes or not, which also I wasn't aware of the Malaysian example, but again, that was a similar sort of plan struck down by them because of the fact that it would effectively usher in a form of age discrimination against their constitution. So I guess my question for you, Chris, is if there is hope, is it in it just collapsing under the weight of its own... or the Supreme Court, who suddenly become my favourite...
It could be. You know, you see all kinds of weird judicial rulings these days. They tend to be authoritarian rather than libertarian, obviously. But I'm no lawyer, as you know, Tom, but it seems to be a pretty clear-cut case of age discrimination.
You'd think so.
I mean, it's what it's all about, is age discrimination. So is it legal under the Equality Act? I don't know. I'd like to see maybe the tobacco companies bring a case and we can find out. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that is the only hope, because obviously it's going to go through on this kind of tidal wave of well-meaning paternalism. I still don't think a lot of people understand what this law is, and I think people are going to get a shock on like the 1st of January 2027 when the first 18-year-old is turned away from trying to buy tobacco, and people go, oh, I thought this was just about stopping 14-year-olds smoking. So, yeah, well, there's 14-year-olds 18 now. This is that was always going to happen.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think a lot of people understand it. And like Claire says, you know, people are they fooling themselves, trying to fool other people when they say this is not about prohibition? It literally... is. It's going to come in. And I think I've said before that in a way it doesn't really matter that much because the tobacco taxes now are so high and are going to keep on going up and up and up. The black market is already enormous and will only grow. So by the time this actually has real teeth, in other words, by the time it's affecting people in the kind of mid-20s who can't even get an older brother to buy their fags from anymore, the market is going to be mostly illicit anyway, I would think. I'm more concerned about the vaping stuff and these Henry VIII powers.
Yeah, I agree.
Because we're talking here about vape advertising, which is probably just going to be banned outright anyway. We're talking about e-cigarette flavours, which are absolutely crucial, but people don't understand what purpose they serve. Obviously, the e-cigarettes have got a taste of something, and adults quite like flavours, funnily enough. But we've seen various European countries using flavour bans as a backdoor way of effectively, you know, cancelling the whole category, and also like where you can smoke, where you can vape, all this effectively is just being handed to Wes Streeting. You don't need any more legislation.
No.
Wes Streeting wants to ban smoking and vaping outdoors and ban all e-cigarette flavours, and he's perfectly entitled to. I believe even the Hansard Society has have raised concerns about this. Mm-hmm. And these are not, you know, libertarians. On the grounds,
it's like an enabling act.
It's constitutionally improper, I think, is their argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's genuinely shocking from that point of view alone. Mm-hmm. It's twice as many powers than the previous bill. And this enormous number of Henry VIII powers, which really does just hand it to the Secretary of State. Just on the vaping stuff, all the evidence, you know, I'm not one for saying the evidence shows, but as we have to listen to being hectored by people who say it, we just like to point out that all the evidence shows that where you remove flavoured vapes, people go back to smoking or don't move over to vaping, because one of the things that's attractive about vaping is that you might want to vape and have a taste that is different to the tobacco that you're trying to give up. That's part of the thing. And they have this ludicrous situation, which is a point I made in the speech, which to my horror was one that was picked up by the media. And I said, of all the weighty things that I've talked about, that's a lot, the one bloody thing I get headline news on is my penchant for, you know, strawberry flavoured vapes or banana or whatever. Disposables,
that,
yeah. Right?
And I read that first you're stockpiling all, like, them.
Yeah, I'm stockpiling I'm genuinely terrified about the
I honestly don't think you're going to struggle to get old disposable vapes.
No, but all I'm saying is it's ludicrous nonetheless. But the flavour vapes, there is a serious point. It's how dare they? They basically go around saying adults don't like sweet things. I pointed out the growing market of fruit-flavoured gins would rather indicate that this was not true. Never mind the fact that lots of people buy sweets.
Yeah. But it's just a slice of cake.
The preposterous nature of it. But you're illicit. Can I just say on the tobacco thing? I already know that lots of people who I know smoke, and I now don't smoke. I mean, I can't even believe I'm saying that. It's like almost a miracle, and I thank vaping for that. Lots of people I know who smoke are buying illicitly. I mean, it is now a sort of open trade that you can walk into various shops and just go, can I have 200? Do you see what I mean? Like, that's what's happening. And this naivety on their part, which is they say, we are assured that there will not be a growth in illicit trade. There will not, you know, all the historic lessons of prohibition completely forgotten. Oh, no. People will just stop smoking. Tobacco will just go away. Mm. And it's like, are you... I mean, it shows a rather poor level of political acumen that they just refuse to accept and genuinely seem naive and don't understand. And most of them have never smoked in their life. You know, they've got no clue about the world of... And you could say, well, that's all right then. But everybody who stood up and spoke in this bill, so many people stood up and said, my father died of lung cancer, my mother died of lung cancer. You know, tragic stories. And my father died of lung cancer due to smoking. And we're all aware of that. But they were people who wanted to stress only that it leads to death and that therefore they couldn't understand why anyone would want to smoke. And the fact that they can't understand why anyone would want to smoke is an indication of why they're not fit to make a bill about it, because they don't actually even understand how to encourage people to stop smoking, which... The irony is that I don't mind people trying to encourage people to stop smoking. You're allowed to do that in a free society. Feel free. But one of the most successful methods of doing that is to encourage people to take up something like vaping. Yep. And along come the government and go, oh, no.
I got a text from a friend over the weekend. It said, man in the corner shop where I buy vapes talking about the ban says to me, don't worry, my friend, I will get for you, and winks.
It's just an open secret now. It's not like when people talk about the black market in tobacco, say, like, it's not like people are buying this out of the boot of a car in a car park.
No.
It's just over the counter.
Yeah, yeah.
But just a supply that is otherwise not on display.
I have also been reassured by a local shop who said, we will help you stock up, but I mean, people know, right? And what's going to happen to all those disposable vapes, by the way? Where are they going to go? Burn them? No, they're going to be available. But you can also, I mean, it's one of these things where, I mean, I it's difficult not to just rant about this thing. But the most important thing is there is nothing wrong with vapes.
Mm.
And the ban on disposable vapes, which has been brought in by DEFRA, it's not even brought in by public health fanatics, is on the basis that of litter and all the rest of it and the environment. And you just think, oh, somebody said to me, why don't you make it that you get a pound deposit back if you take a vape back? People would be going around collecting them and handing them back in, right? There are ways of doing this, not in the way that they're doing it. And your point about the ban on advertising is actually quite serious. They are effectively saying that you won't be able to tell anyone that there are vapes in your shop, you know, that you can't have any pictorial, you know. So in other words, they're putting people off adopting nicotine use. And nicotine is not tobacco, is not smoking. Mm-hmm. But they are conflating the two, which is counterproductive, even from a public health point of view.
Yeah, but it's just them moralising books. Yeah. You know, I think a lot of them realise nicotine's actually not harmful. They just don't care. They don't think you should be enjoying something potentially addictive that, you know, doesn't seem to serve any purpose other than to be enjoyed.
Yeah.
You know, France are in the process of banning nicotine pouches. Right? A few countries are banning nicotine pouches. These are the safest nicotine products you'll probably ever see. There's nothing, there's no tobacco in them. Mm-hmm. It's basically cellulose and a bit of nicotine, right? The French are banning them. Not even sure what their stated reason is. Probably some nonsense about the gateway effect.
It's un-French.
The maximum penalty. Right, yeah. Well, true. If that was it, you wouldn't mind, would you? But they're clamping down on cigarettes as well. And the maximum penalty for possession, not even for selling them. So they're making it legal to possess.
Oh, my God.
Nicotine pouches. 5 years in prison.
Oh, my God.
Heroin's 1 year in prison. In France.
But the nicotine pouches, just an indication of the, again, lack of evidence, was somebody actually in a briefing who is a medic, a senior medic, you know, like the Lords is full of these people who ran medical societies and all the rest of it, said, what are we going to do about nicotine pouches? I'm worried they're not affected by the bill. Can't we introduce them? So, of course, there's going to be amendments, right? And they said, because that can lead to mouth cancer. And what? even one of the kind of rather sheepish spads or civil servants had to say, no, nicotine doesn't lead to mouth cancer. It's not tobacco. Mm. And this sort of medic was like, oh, what's the difference? I don't really, you know what I mean? Like, didn't know. Somebody else raised the issue and said, you keep citing Sweden as a way forward. But actually, smoking has gone down in Sweden, but snus has gone up. And that's illegal in this country. And they're going, what's snus? And I'm thinking, no, but they didn't. The point being, which is say, are we trying to emulate Sweden where actually they
been
are
a great
actually,
success.
Yeah, as a success.
Vastly lower smoking
rate. But I'm saying that they cannot really, they haven't got any clarity, which is why you're absolutely right. It's just a moralising demand. It's not a practical policy.
It's the answer to that thought experiment. You know, if you could come up with a cigarette that didn't kill you or alcohol that didn't have all the negative effects, would they still want to ban it? The answer here is absolutely.
Very clear, yeah. That's that for thought experiment answered.
Shall we move on and talk about another misguided policy, that of Martin's Law, Claire? This is something that I've seen you speaking about recently. It was something which came out the back of the horrendous Manchester Arena bombing, where the family of Martin Hett, who was one of the people who was killed by the Abadies that awful night, were campaigning for a change in the law around venues which admit a certain number of people. It was finally put into law by the government last year, but now people are starting to realise that the negative consequences of it, the unintended consequences, is so often a topic on this show. So essentially, if I've got this right, if you're an event or a venue that would admit 200 or more people, you just have to have some kind of policy in place saying what would happen in the event of an attack, something that might take you a bit of time, it doesn't really cost you very much. But if it's over 800 people, then you actually have to have bag checks, you have to have CCTV, there's all these different conditions which actually cost a fair amount of money. We've already seen the Shrewsbury Flower Festival announce that it's not going to go ahead this year after almost 150 years, in part because of these restrictions and the cost that they would impose. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about this law and what it reveals, I guess.
I think the fact that it's called terrorism, first word in brackets, something like Public Premises, you know, Act, is an indication of what an absolute sleight of hand it is, because it makes it seem as though terrorism is going to be stopped by this piece of legislation. And I was, one of the people who just found it infuriating that every time you objected to any aspect of this bill, immediately you were given a lecture about fighting terrorism. This is the same people who at the same time were you know, allowing people to get through prevent training. You know, I mean, these are not the people who can lecture about stopping terrorism because they won't name the main source of terrorism, i.e. Islamism. And there was a big row going on at the same time with the same minister about those very things. So it was infuriating to be told this. And we also know that the Manchester Arena bombing, the problem was not that you didn't have security guards who were keeping their eye out. In fact, the security guard who actually saw the bomber and knew that he looked suspicious and was worried about him carrying a big rucksack and so on, wouldn't approach because he didn't want to be accused of racism. So I pointed out, well, you know, that would, but that might be something to tackle. You know, the idea that this kind of technocratic mechanism, just on the 200, I think actually, if you're a venue or any kind of civil society public gathering between 200 and 800, even though it seems as though there's not much required in a regulatory fashion, actually there is quite a lot, because you still have to have somebody, an individual named person responsible. Can you imagine the... And you're worried about liability. It's very vague in the bill what exactly you have to do. And as a consequence, people will be risk averse, or they will just not have events on. That's what we were all predicting would be the unintended consequence. And people already were reporting in that there were people saying, I'm not going to be a volunteer on that anymore this year because I don't want the burden. I'm worried about it. And then there was also, there's report writing and all of these things. It's, you know, these are often small venues. It was also unclear whether the venue or the event organizer would be responsible. Never got clarified in my mind. So this was something that every single one of us who tried to raise objections predicted would happen, that you're trying to stop terrorism and what you're actually going to stop is the local Gymkhana or the Summer Fete. And so the first high profile example is a Shrewsbury Flower Show, but there will be many others.
Absolutely. And it's such a displacement activity as well. I understand why the family were campaigning for this change. Of course, we completely respect that. But the way in which this is leapt upon, implemented almost without a second thought. Meanwhile, you take something like the Manchester Arena bombing, the amount of kind of state failures which lead up to that horrendous evening are legion. You know, the fact that the Abadi brothers, the Abadi family, were able to travel back and forth from Britain to Libya, fighting in the civil war, training with Islamists and so on. The fact that MI5 eventually had to apologise because they actually had information that they didn't act upon in a prompt enough fashion that might have apprehended him. There's a lot of questions about why the why Salman Abadi wasn't kind of picked up by counter-extremism schemes more readily, given the fact that he was quite clearly an ISIS sympathizer, was beating up women at school for not being dressed appropriately, all these kinds of things. Do you think, but their answer to this on a legislative level is we need to put in bag checks at flower shows. It's just a displacement activity.
So much of politics is now. You know, the state is fundamentally useless and inept and kind of knows it. And we just keep on piling regulation on law-abiding people while essentially letting the lawbreakers do what they like. You know, the reality, if you want to blow up, if you want to kill lots of people, it's not hard to do it. No one's actually going to stop you doing it. We had the 7/7 you know, bombings. Nothing's actually changed. If you want to go on a tube or a bus with a bomb in your bag, there's nothing we can do to stop you. You can go to a train station. There's all sorts of places you could go if you wanted to kill a huge number of people. You're unlikely to be doing it at this flower show or something like that. But I guess, you know, nothing's going to prevent somebody who wants to do that from doing it. What we need to do is stop people who want to do that from being in the country, or if they are in the country, to be in prison. And it's, you know, prevent always get the blame for a lot of these things. But do you know how many people are on the terror watch list? You can't really do it. You can't just bang people up before they've done something, right? It's not Minority Report. So it's an incredibly difficult situation, but you know, we are letting in, very likely, a non-trivial number of terrorists every year on small boats. No one seems to have any idea how you're gonna, we're going to stop that. Instead, we're just now apparently giving lots of landlords via Serco a huge amount of money to house these people. It's a very obvious failure of the state, right? If you can't even control your own borders at all. And yet we're going around and, you know, making life miserable for some old woman who's trying to run some village fete or whatever. You know, it's ridiculous, but it's just time and time again, the state is failing. People can see it. That's why so many people are leaving the country now. You know, Dubai is full of British people who've just had enough. And they're, you know, they're the talented people for the most part. And the people who are just arriving in their tens of thousands
flocking to the Gulf to escape Islamism is a kind of, you know, interesting paradox that we've got going at the moment.
But it's a mess, isn't it? But you really explained well the failures around the Abadi brother that blew himself and those innocent people up, and not just killed 22 people, but, you know, maimed and destroyed the lives of so many more. The second Abadi is in prison, and he's just managed to throw boiling oil over it. You know,
yeah, they
and,
put
and
him
and
in charge of the chip farm.
All I'd say is, in the meantime, we spent hours and hours and hours and hours and hours in the House of Lords just debating this silly bill. And they kept saying, some of us really care about stopping terrorism. You know, they'd look at me, right, you don't. You know what I mean? Like, and this is why it's so frustrating. But just on the emotional blackmail, because I found that intolerable, was the other aspect of this, even though I'm very sympathetic and understand why Martin Hecht's family would want to be involved in feeling they were doing something constructive, it's also the case that law should not be decided in this way.
Yeah.
And so everybody kept standing up and saying, Fegan Murray is a brave woman who's, you know, fought this. Yeah. And you could see the minister and the... nobody could say a word that would contradict what Fegan Murray had said. But Fegan Murray is a desperately, absolutely, understandably heartbroken mother who's trying to do something. But somebody needs to say, this is not the thing to do. This wouldn't have stopped your son being blown up, and we're not going to make law based on that.
Yeah.
And we keep seeing these examples, even to the Esther Ranson has led to the most disgusting bill on assisted dying being proposed and completely. But it's more that government ministers and politicians, their only link in a way with kind of public opinion is to find somebody who's told them that this is what they want, and then they can say, we're only doing it because the public told us. And they kept citing Fegan Murray. And at one point, somebody stopped me in the corridor and said, did you know that when you made that point about Fegan Murray and the campaign, that she was in the chamber? And I said, I didn't know, but anyway.
You just said the same
and they
thing
said, well, I think maybe you ought to consider that you might really have, you know, being very upset and offended. And I'd had exactly the same thing happen about the father of the young woman who committed suicide, who's inspired the online safety bill, where somebody effectively warned me off and said, you should be careful what you say. And then you do realise that politicians are completely spineless, that they really do feel that they cannot upset or offend. Now, there's no, of course, need to be offensive. But on the other hand, that shouldn't be how you make laws.
It's not a way to make laws. It's emotional blackmail, as you say. I mean, there's too much of it goes on. It's a golden rule, generally, in politics. Most people accept, I think, that if you've got somebody's name in the legislation, it's going to be a bad law. Hard cases make bad law is a cliche for a reason. You see it in all over the various public health, you know, gambling is completely dominated by a tiny handful of people who supposedly took their own lives because they were gambling. And you've got the parents going, we want to bring in this, we want to ban gambling advertising. You get it with road safety. People, children have died. I'm sorry, but being a victim or being a relatives of a victim doesn't make you an expert on legislation. And if anything, you're probably the last person actually to listen to on this because you're so emotionally attached to the issue, you're not going to see any trade-offs.
And it's also
no one wants to say that, but it's the truth.
No, absolutely. But it's also interesting which victims the politicians will listen to and which they won't, or which victims' families the politicians will listen to and which they won't. You know, when the whole grooming gangs discussion erupting recently, no one cared the fact that you had various victims groups saying we do want a national inquiry. And whether or not that was a good idea is a separate question. But in that situation, they were very... could confidently say, no, we know better and it should be like this. So there's always, you know, hypocrisies all the way down, I guess, and double standards. Shall we talk, Chris, about something you've been writing about recently? I understand you've written an IEA paper and a piece for The Critic. I've read The Critic piece, I haven't got around to the IEA paper yet, I will admit, about this concept that you often hear bandied around in the sort of nanny state world of the corporate playbook.
Yeah.
I know you wanted to talk a little bit about this.
In particular with relation to food advertising, actually. So I wrote this paper, which just looks at the idea that there is a tobacco playbook, right? Something that a phrase is often bandied around. and it sounds bad because it involves tobacco, and it sounds very devious if there's some sort of playbook out there. Obviously, this playbook does not literally exist, and I would say it doesn't even metaphorically exist either. It's just a catch-all term for any kind of opposition to any kind of public health policy. Mm-hmm. They will accuse whoever it is of using this tobacco playbook, and then the politicians go, "Oh, I don't want to be, you know, taken for a ride."
By which they mean opposing the policy or something. Essentially.
Opposing the policy. Yeah. Essentially, just means it basically means disagreeing with the policy,
yep.
arguing about the evidence for it, and then doing things like lobbying or going on the media. This is part of the tobacco playbook. Now, obviously, anybody who's engaged in the political process at all is going to be doing things like lobbying and engaging with the media and building coalitions and mm-hmm. stuff like that. The public health groups do it more than anyone, if anything, right? So are the public health groups using the tobacco playbook, or actually is this just a useless, very broad and vague term that is just used as a piece of political rhetoric? But just before the paper came out, there was something in the British Medical Journal about so-called junk food advertising, right? High in fat, sugar and salt advertising. We've got a ban coming in October, which is going to ban less healthy food advertising online in all its forms and on TV before 9 o'clock, I think on radio as well. Now, this is one of, if not the most extreme piece of legislation affecting food advertising anywhere in the world. Boris Johnson agreed to it when he was at his lowest ebb during COVID, and no one else is really lining up to copy this particular policy. It's another hangover, obviously, from the previous Tory government. But it's coming in October, and you would think that the campaigners would be delighted by this, but if they are, they're not really showing it. What they're doing instead is already saying this: we need to go further. So we got the slippery slope. You know, on one hand, we've got the tobacco and vapes bill going through, which is kind of the end of the story for one product, and now we see the beginning of the story, really, for some other products, right? And there's no reason to think it's not going to end the same way if we allow that to happen. But they're going about it exactly the same way. This is the irony, right? There's an anti-tobacco playbook, which is actually being... Well, there is, right? They're actually following the anti-tobacco playbook. We want health warnings on these food products. We want to have an advertising ban. We'll start with TV, and then we'll move incrementally to the rest of the media, because that's exactly what they did with tobacco. And we want taxes. We've got the sugar tax already. You know, that genuinely is a blueprint of just copying anti-smoking regulation, and it's kind of projection for these people to accuse everybody else of using the tobacco playbook. Anyway, so the name of the game at the moment is to kind of gaslight us into believing that these extremely draconian advertising restrictions mm-hmm. have been watered down by the food industry and the advertising industry, and actually the natural course of events would be for all this kind of advertising to be banned, and the food industry has used a tobacco playbook to dilute it. The truth is that the campaign has got everything they asked for. They're just asking for something more now and pretending like they always have. Right? So in the British Medical Journal, you've got this woman called Catherine Jenner from Obesity Health Alliance, who used to be at Action on Sugar. So many
pressure groups. To one, really.
Yeah, Action on Sugar. She used to go around to the media... Action on Sugar's big thing was like looking at the ingredients on food products and however much sugar was in it, that she'd say, "This is shocking. It's a shocking amount of sugar. I'm shocked at how much sugar is in this product." So she did that for a few years, and now she's at the Obesity Health Alliance, where she goes on about the tobacco playbook. And apparently some local councils, not many, very few actually, but some local councils have reported being lobbied by the people who own outdoor advertising space when they try and ban so-called junk food adverts on like bus shelters and stuff. And the advertising companies or the trade association has basically been doing its job a little bit by giving a counter argument to this and saying quite reasonably to the councils, you will lose money if you do this, because the councils, you know, they own quite a bit of the advertising space. It's pretty obvious that they will lose money. Mm. That's why the advertising companies are concerned about this. Right? They know that if you have an advertising ban, that will mean less advertising, which means less business for them, but also less money for the council.
I've got my head around this.
But apparently this is a tobacco playbook of arguing over settled science. And then she crops up again the other day in a slightly different context, but used exactly the same phrase. This is the tobacco playbook.
Yeah.
So my point is, it doesn't exist, but they are trying to ban all food advertising, and then eventually, or so-called junk food advertising, and... The lesson from the tobacco and vapes, but I guess, is one day they will try and ban
all
various food products. Not all
food,
Tom. You'll still be able to get fruit and veg, I expect.
No, there we go. That's good. That's
although there is a shocking level of sugar in some fruit.
It's quite shocking. I've seen it out, but it's incredible.
I was shocked.
Claire, what do you make of all this? Particularly, I suppose, the way in which this reflex to brand these things as either corporate talking points or someone's in the payoff or someone's mouthing the points of big tobacco or of big sugar or whatever it is that they're calling these things. What do you make of that tactic? Because it's everywhere in this area of debate.
Certainly. Oh, absolutely. And it's a way of discrediting you by saying that, you know, you've talked to big somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a kind of industry of big vapes or big tobacco or
big food
or big... First of all, it's just worth noting that the nature of lobbying is that somebody says, we represent this group and we want to explain to you why you should agree with us. Yeah. It's called democratic politics at any level. And I've just talked about Fegan Murray and the campaign around Martin's Law. They got that through lobbying, right? Somehow lobbying doesn't... They say lobbying is like something sinister. It's like... Yeah.
When they do it, it's advocacy.
Well, you just write action on smoking, you know, ASH. What's the H stand for? I can't remember.
Health. Smoking and health.
I mean, ASH are constantly, you know, I get sent the briefings from ASH just as a peer, and I hear other peers standing up and reading verbatim, word for word, the ASH briefings. But that apparently is not... that's not lobbying and that's not being put under any pressure, but they're like literally reading out a briefing. and I just find it's like two-tier everything. It's like that double standards, you know. It's infuriating that the assumption is that if somebody sends you an argument or talks to you or anything, that A, that you're just such a numpty, you just go along with it, or that you won't work out what you think having listened to all sides, and that all sides should be able to say what they think. And I mean, this is quite a serious situation we're in now, because advertising is an industry. And as it happens, food is an industry. And it's perfectly legitimate to have industries, funnily enough, in an advanced capitalist country, although we are obviously not an advanced capitalist country at this rate. We're a kind of backwardly going out the way, right?
Backwardly, I mean, socialist country.
There is a kind of, you're not apparently going to have any industries. So much for growth, right? Because everybody that is a big industry can be accused of this kind of lobbying, and it drives me mad. And I think we've got to do more to call out, by the way, the NGOs and the charities and all the rest of it who pull this, who try and get away with this. And it's just the double standards of it. You know, I really enjoyed your article in The Critic, and I would, anyone watching should really read it. It's a great article, it makes fantastic points. It's in the British Medical Journal. You're citing the British Medical Journal. You know, the British Medical Association yesterday said that the Supreme Court's decision on clarifying the reality of biological sex, they said, was scientifically illiterate.
Bloody hell.
Right?
There is no hope.
But then you think, this is what's so ironic. You know, usually the people who lecture you about the importance of the Supreme Court being the final word on everything.
How dare you criticise them?
The people who say that you need evidence, and where's your scientific evidence? And here is a scientific fact.
Yeah. Right? Very, very straightforward.
And they're saying it's scientifically illiterate.
That's incredible.
Because of ideology. And, you know, the British Medical Journal, happy to, you know, to endorse one view. I mean, I'm just making the point that the double standards on these things are, I think, what has doing a lot of damage, by the way, to what we all want, which is some sense of truth and not, you know, going down the rabbit hole into conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to hold the line when actually the relativism about what's true, what's not true, is coming from campaigners, often public health campaigners, who've made a mockery of reality, scientific reality, and really destroyed our ability to say, no, actually, this is the evidence, or actually, I have got an expert opinion, because they've discredited that view by actually turning it into a political way of bashing you over the head. So,
And all this stuff about lobbying, I completely agree with you. Lobbying is an important thing. Actually, maybe there should be more of it, you know. But it does feed into this kind of paranoid mindset.
Yeah.
If you read stuff by someone like George Monbiot, for example.
I try not to.
Well, I can't resist it sometimes because I've had to chart his kind of descent into madness. But, you know, it's just genuine paranoia. All about lobbying, think tanks he's obsessed with for some reason. He just thinks these things are much more powerful than they are. You know, all a lobbyist can do is make an argument, maybe present you with some evidence. Maybe that evidence is dodgy, maybe not. But you've got to
hope that the politicians or the person being lobbied has enough sense to be able to distinguish it's obviously a biased claim, right? You know that this person is not impartial, and decide for themselves.
It's sort of wrapped up, isn't it, with the way in which, whereas the left previously might have had a more sort of structural critique of capitalism, now it's entirely conspiratorial. It's like there are these people in a room pulling the strings, greasing these palms, and that's why we have the laws that we have, that's why everyone's unhealthy, that's why this and that is happening.
Lobbying has kind of become a deus ex machina explanation for everything, and particularly in public health. So in public health, if they lose their campaign for whatever it is, increasing the amount of, the extent of the advertising ban or whatever, if they succeed, they go, well, this is a victory for public health, and obviously we succeeded because we had the evidence on our side. And if they lose, they just go, it was lobbying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's always lobbying, presumably, so why are you winning some of these cases and not other cases? And that's kind of what I say in the report, actually, is that it doesn't contribute anything to our understanding of the policymaking process to have this theory about a playbook which apparently works really effectively sometimes, but then in very similar cases doesn't work at all. And the reason is because it's got nothing, there isn't a playbook, it's got nothing nothing to do with that. They're a funny lot looking for.
But they're basically delegitimizing. I mean, it's a demon. I mean, once they say tobacco, big tobacco has sent this out, there will be all sorts of accusations like that, I know, in the debates in the Lords, but there are in general, aren't there? People will say to me, oh, you won Smoker of the Year from Forest, so therefore you're in the payoff. There's this notion that no one has got any agency whatsoever, can't think for themselves, everybody's funded by someone, and I'm afraid that some people is no longer just confined to the Monbiot loony public health left.
Absolutely,
it's become embraced by sections of the right. I mean, not that these terms are always helpful, but you know what I mean? He'll sort of say, oh, you've once been to Davos. I've never been to Davos, but in case of work. I mean, you've once been to Davos. Now that it doesn't mean anything, I might get invited, now that it's got no influence whatsoever. But what I mean is this idea that somebody's pulling your strings is a constant way of explaining things. Yes. And it drives me mad because I actually get now, in the Lords, get sent things from absolutely everyone. And the worst thing is, I'm one of those, I'm like SWATs. I print out lots of briefings by all sorts of people and I read them, right? And, a good 80% of them I disagree with, but I'm interested to know why this group, what is the NSPCC saying about the children's well-being and schools? Well, even though when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, oh my God, you don't think that, do you? But, nonetheless, I want to know. Bernardo sent an interesting briefing, disagree with most of it, but there's a real snippet of insight on one bit, and so on and so forth.
Maybe what if you do disagree, is you want to know your enemy, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you read around because you're not just kind of, actually, the opposite of a playbook. You simply don't just go, oh yeah, I'm on that side, so I'll just read that. And I've made the point, by the way, that I think it is ludicrous that the tobacco companies are going for this 21, raise the age of selling tobacco to 21. And I, of course, will say that to them. In other words, you don't just go, oh, big tobacco said it, and I once was a smoker, and I won Smoker of the Year, therefore I will tick that box. No, that's not what happens. But that's how they describe it. And they've said, by the way, it's this other expression, sorry, is talking points. So what they say is, oh, the whole argument around smoking and tobacco and the illicit trade in the black market is a big tobacco talking point.
Personal liberty is a big tobacco
talking point. You know what I mean? Like if you say anything, or it's a...
an industry argument.
And you just think, no, it's
black
not.
Black market
it's
a myth.
Exactly. You're allowed to... argue against it, don't try and discredit me by associating me with this in order to avoid having the argument about why there might not be an increase in the black market if you make something banned.
You just reminded me that the thing in the British Medical Journal mentions the ban on TFL, advertising, food advertising ban on TFL. Yes. And this, I think it was that Catherine Jenner woman, could have been somebody else, was saying, it's part of the tobacco playbook is to deny evidence. And the evidence is from this awful study that came out a few years ago, a modelling study, was supposedly hundreds of thousands of cases of obesity were avoided or something. And the average London household is consuming 1,000 fewer calories a week as a result of this minor piece of regulation. It's obviously absurd stuff. But it was published in a journal, and it says what these people want them to say. So if you deny it, you're using the tobacco industry playbook. And even there in the BMJ article, it said these people have used the fact that obesity rose in London, childhood obesity rose in London after the ban came in, and in fact rose faster than any other part of the country. Because that sounds like quite a strong argument, to be honest with you. I don't know if it's an industry argument or not, but it sounds quite persuasive. But finally, and you reminded me, Claire, also, what I was struggling to think of before, there's a point about delegitimizing your opponents, essentially. That is actually the whole point of this mini-literature about the corporate playbook. It is to say that all these companies, from infant formula to pharmaceuticals even, are using the tobacco playbook, and therefore we should treat them like the tobacco industry. And because there is an international treaty saying, basically, that governments shouldn't engage with the tobacco industry, don't engage with any of these industries. And from the point of view of these neo-Puritans, that's a perfect situation to be in, because who wouldn't like to have your entire opposition excluded so you're the only person who can be whispering into politicians' ears?
I also think that a few of the things that we've talked about today. The other thing that I was just thinking when you were talking, because it was at one of the briefings at the Lords, that Chris Whitty was the one who said this is the tobacco playbook.
Oh, or, did he?
Well, no, not the tobacco. Big tobacco talking point. And one of the things that is extraordinary is that, you know, Chris Whitty talked to Rishi Sunak and said, if you bring in this generational tobacco ban, you know, you will save hundreds of thousands of lives and you will be historically remembered. And there's a kind of real, you know, for stopping people ever getting lung cancer again, you know what I mean? So there's a kind of very, there's lobbying goes on in all sorts of ways, is what I'm trying to say. And apparently Rishi Sunak thought, oh, this is, even though
he's
never,
like Rasputin, witty, as far as I'm concerned. He's always whispering in the ear.
He was there in the room and I got all confused and I said, the noble Lord, Lord Witty. Because, and then he thought, he's not a lord. I know. That was me getting confused with Valance, because Valance is a lord.
Oh, is he?
And they all kind of merge in my head. The reason I'm saying that is because it's just that he was there as the kind of chief medical officer. And in fact, he was using politicized and emotional arguments, exactly as you say, to try and delegitimize. So I actually said, I think it's inappropriate for you to try and delegitimize this argument by using that to talk about the tobacco industry. Answer the argument.
Good on you.
Right? And then he kind of just smiles wryly, right? They won't do it. But I do think Christmas. There's a really emotional... What I was going to say was, I think, just like we were saying about the relatives, you know, using the relatives' grief, these kind of personalised stories of people saying about my father died of lung cancer and all of these kind of things, and also just the way that everything is emotional, this will save lives, and that you're just meant to agree. And as a consequence, the real evidence gets thrown out the window. It's emotional bullying, never mind blackmail, you know, it's absolute bullying every time. You're meant to shut up. You're on the side of big business who doesn't care about people's lives and you want them all to die, or you're a good person on our side.
Yeah.
And children always get dragged into this.
Chief medical officer should be a bit above that kind of rhetoric.
Yeah. And children are constantly used, protecting children. And it's so disingenuous, it drives me mad.
It's awful. Chris Whitty is awful. This country is a waste of space. Where are we going to move to? Let's get back to this subject. Where are we going to move to?
It's a segment, doesn't it? Where is Chris going to move to?
Dubai or Malta currently are the,
oh my God.
Are the front runners.
Can I just say, absolutely not. We've got to stay and fight the good fight.
Wow. Feels like a very long fight at the moment. But
it does.
We're on the subject of fighting liberalism. Claire, before we get out of here, we do have this segment on our show. You've answered the question yourself a few times before. That if you had to have one ban, what would it be? The only rules being that it can't be anything too worthy.
You are a dictator.
Is there anything that's irked you since you've last been on?
Over the years, haven't you?
Actually,
do you remember your previous one?
No, I can't.
I think Ed Davey was the last one I remember.
Was it?
I just wanted to ban Ed Davey. I just, one line bill, you know. Just.
Well, actually, why don't we go for ban Chris Whitty?
Yeah,
that seems
popular choice.
Rather, ban Chris Whitty from acting as the final word on advice to ministers about what kind of laws they should bring in, because it's been disastrous so far.
I'll tell you what. Speaking about Davey and speaking of things you like to ban, he the Lib Dems have finally come up with a brilliant policy. It's not very liberal, admittedly, and maybe we might find a
bit. It's made for this podcast.
Maybe
so
we might
find
a bit of division here between me and Claire. I don't know, but he wants to fine people £1,000 for playing music on their phones on public transport, and I think, if anything, that's too lenient. But it's a step in the right direction. But obviously, some people. I was asked to go on GB News or something because they assumed I'd be against this. I said, no, it's the best policy that Lib Dems have ever come up with. What are you talking about? But there are one or two people say it's a bit liberal. Claire, what do you think?
Draconian nonsense, but
really?
Very popular, including with me.
Oh,
but
okay.
I do. We all agree, but we also know that what really should happen is that we as adults should have the courage and the confidence to go up and say, turn that music off or put the headphones in.
Yeah, I don't want to get stabbed.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Because we won't do that, we therefore want to rely on the law, but we should know.
But that's true. You could say that about a lot of things.
You've got to be brave, Chris.
You do. What?
We will lose some people in the process, but if we, you know.
I'm not going to be.
With courage.
Basically, what will happen is I'll sit there and go, I wish they'd be quiet.
Well, I've got my headphones in, so it doesn't really affect me. But it is. It's just a sign of absolute moral decay that there are people prepared to do that.
And something about social solidarity, you know, kind of like any kind of social contract is kind of given them where people don't care that they're being
very
really
annoying,
irritating and upsetting. And that's the thing, is it really is like feet on the, you know, putting your feet on the seats and so on and so forth. There's something about it that's very depressing. But I do think that people actually, a lot of young people don't almost even know they're doing it. And it's just like a world.
And older people,
I mean,
as well. It's just gone across the age ranges
really?
Now.
Old
it's just,
people
yeah,
doing
I can
it.
See this all the time.
Yeah, but that's partly that the old people haven't worked out how to do that.
That's true.
It is also
they probably can't hear it as well.
No, it is also true that I once realised, to my absolute horror, on a train journey, I've been playing the Archers for 20 minutes to the whole carriage because I hadn't put them.
So, well, you had your headphones on.
Yes.
So you didn't it notice it wasn't coming through your headphones.
So it goes through, you know.
No.
The Archers as well.
I could hear it. The humiliation of realising that my headphones weren't properly plugged in.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what are the old people playing on their phones? But is this Radio 4? Look, that's the most annoying thing of all, probably.
I agree.
Old episodes of Catchphrase.
Rather listen
you know,
to
like,
drill music.
I never, ever, ever wanted anyone to know I was listening to the Archers.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Last Orders. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you subscribe and click the bell so that you never miss another Spiked video. If you're listening to this on your podcast app, make sure you subscribe there and leave us a glowing 5-star review. And if you'd like to get in touch with your questions or band suggestions, email us at lastorders@spiked-online.com.